are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Thursday, June 21st, 2018. My name is Michael Brooks on a Michael Thursday, and this is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. On today's program, how a reputation laundering firm ruined its own reputation. The story of a London-based PR strategy crisis communications firm that worked for the Gupta family in South Africa and tried to save the kleptocratic presidency of Jacob Zuma, a right-wing Tory-aligned PR agency that fueled a pseudo-populist campaign, media campaign, in South Africa. Talking about that with the New Yorker's Ed Caesar. Also, family separations will persist under Donald Trump's new executive order. There is no language in the order of specifically how the thousands of children that have already been separated by this terrorist policy will be reunited with their parents. And nor does the order restore the old approach of not doing just that. The GOP fears chaos and confusion ahead of a House vote on Bob Gutlet's far-right immigration bill. Tech companies quietly work with ICE as the crisis continues. Companies like Thomson Reuters, Hewlett-Packard, Microsoft, Motorola Solutions, Palantir, as well as others. And Trump is going to empower Mick Mulvaney to target the social safety net across the board. And it's been a busy couple of days because the Trump administration has also just erased an Obama-era policy to protect the oceans of the globe. See, I'm just tired of voting for evil. I want to vote for what I believe in. The Senate rejects billions in Trump spending cuts as two Republicans vote no, Richard Burr and Susan Collins. And Scott Pruitt has spent a total of $4.6 million on security, including $1,500 on tactical pants. I didn't know he was an Archer fan. And protests continue in Nicaragua. The rightward turn of Daniel Ortega is real, as is potentially a U.S. foreign influence and interference in Nicaraguan politics to dislodge their own enemy. And former President Luis Ignacio Lula da Silva has been appointed a football commentator for Brazilian TV network and will be writing and commenting on the games from prison, even as he still leads in the polls. Free Lula. The Brazilian elites feeling pressure heading towards a June 26th court date that may in fact release him. All that and more on today's Majority Report.
Sports as a site of struggle.
Sports as a site of struggle. I love it. I also love Lula was in a hearing. I mean, I admire. I think a shorthand goal of modern politics should be free Lula in prison Trump. Should be two of our sort of main aspirations and focuses. I'm paraphrasing it, but he was in a hearing, and the judge at this hearing actually said, he was via video conference from prison, and the judge said, I supported you in the past or something to that effect. He gave him some nice words, and Lula was like, well, you'll be able to do so again soon. Just the chutzpah on that bull, Lula, and the ongoing lawfare coup in Brazil will stay on. Ed Caesar's joining us at 12:30, so we're going to do a little bit of stuff that is typically reserved for the fun half, and we're going to start with some real fun. Every single time any of us have done any videos on Jordan Peterson, and I have some announcement, actually, that's coming soon. More work to be done on Jordan Peterson is the simplest way I could tease it. There's always a band of his cultists who really are sad, just sad, who will always say, like, how about having a conversation with him? He would wipe the floor with you. You people are totally out of his depth. He's a true intellect. And I don't preclude having a conversation with Jordan Peterson. Maybe it'll happen one day. Frankly, I doubt it, probably more on his end. He, of course, totally begged off of having a conversation with Douglas Lane of Zero Books Podcast and debating an actual Marxist when he's, you know, a great deal of his histrionics are about how the Marxists won't debate. But here is an example, and we're not even at Marxism here. This is this is like eighth grade level civics with the Australian Jim Jefferies, comedian. And Jordan Peterson and Jim Jefferies are going to have an exchange, like I imagine actually an exchange between him and I would probably go. This is Jordan Peterson and Jim Jefferies talking about the Baker case, and see where this goes.
Making people bake a cake for a gay wedding.
Making them do it?
Yeah.
I don't think that's a very good idea.
But here's the argument. So should they be able to deny making a cake for a black couple if they don't like black people?
Allowed to? Probably. That doesn't mean it's right.
Okay, so then we had the civil rights movement.
Yep.
Where they said black people, well, you had to serve them in your restaurants and stuff like that. And it did work and it did make our society better. But would you argue that that still wasn't right?
No, that was right.
Why is that different to now if you didn't want to make a cake for black people?
Maybe it's not. Maybe it's not different. Yeah. Maybe I was wrong about that.
I mean, baby steps. I mean, I didn't realize that Jordan Peterson was so influenced by Louis Brandeis in his thinking. Oh, wait, I'm sorry. Obviously, he doesn't know who Louis Brandeis is.
I mean, being able to admit you were wrong is a good quality.
Yes, that's true. That is a very clean your room quality. I appreciated that exchange. I appreciated that he was able to follow logic there. I don't appreciate that this guy has been given a mass platform and built a sort of content, a Western civilizational expanding cult based off, in no small part off of his histrionic nonsense conspiracy theories about politics. And he can't even ground himself in the basic enough understanding to disaggregate things within constitutional law and the history of civil rights protections. I'm not thrilled about that, but I am glad that when it was laid out in front of him, he was able to follow the logic. I have no doubt that a similar experience will never be experienced with Sam Harris. Ever. So credit where credit's due. And maybe we all should host Jordan Peterson and just take him through some like very basic deductive reasoning on everything. Like, oh yeah, I was wrong. My B.
Jordan, my B Peterson.
Yeah, my B. So really, if you say somebody's pronoun wrong, you realize you're not going to go to prison forever.
Well, I realize now as you put the law in front of me and I read it literally out loud. Yes, I was wrong. My B. I'll just stick to writing self-help books.
That'd be, you know what? There would be no beef if that guy just wrote some like fucking clean your room, follow your goals. Nothing wrong with that. Although people should read James Hillman instead of him. James Hillman was a great Jungian psychotherapist. And James Hillman in the 1990s wrote a book called We've Had 100 Years of Therapy and the World is Getting Worse. And the argument was that therapy had become an agent of internalizing problems that were societally created. And therefore, even though he was, and he wasn't, not only was
he. Sounds like Hocus Pocus.
Yeah, what a bunch of bullshit. Meanwhile.
Clean your room.
Yeah. Why don't you clean your room, James Hillman? Oh, you were the head of the Young Institute? Oh, might be.
Someone's been watching too many Adam Curtis documentaries.
Somebody's been watching too many Adam Curtis documentaries. They're too loud. There's too many things. There isn't a linear narrative. And James Hillman, in an interview with a Buddhist magazine, I was just researching this in 1996. The headline is, it's not all in your head. The bosses are really out to get you, says noted Jungian analyst. And then he actually says in the interview, and this is in 1996, that Americans need to start reading Marx and reconnecting with the labor tradition, and that therapy is a noble profession, but all too often what therapists are doing is managing the waste of capitalism. Again, this was a guy who directed the Jung Institute in Zurich. So if there is this like powerful interest in these ideas, some of which I think are actually worthy and fascinating and far more developed by somebody like James Hillman, you should be reminded that you don't have to buy on to, you know, sort of the politics of a Ronald Reagan GE video from the 1960s. There's much more sophisticated things going on.
It's weird what sort of historical lineages get left off of the intellectual dark web.
Isn't that interesting? It's quite interesting. Donald Trump was in Duluth, Minnesota.
Great city.
Which is how I actually...
I really like Duluth. It's an old fur trading town on the Lake Superior.
Is that where Dylan's from? Bob Dylan?
I think he might be. I'm not
sure. I was from Duluth. I have... And there's also a great a buddy of mine, a TMBS patron, smart dude, and a singer-songwriter from Duluth, who... His name is Bob Dylan. Yeah. New patron, Robert Zimmerman. I really like the Nation of Islam Obama impression. I think if Bob Dylan was a comedian, he probably actually would do bits like that. It's a mashup.
He would do impressions of himself.
On my next tour, I'm impersonating myself, and it's layered in. Wow, I really lost the voice on that one. Donald Trump is out of his mind. He's talking about what really constitutes the elite. And what I love about this is this really is actually peak Trump. One, because, you know, he's a fascist, and he's gearing up for re-election. He's a clown, vintage Trump clown fascism. Two, because... he resents the elites, and he knows that he likes to play to the rubes, but he also clearly resents the fact that he is not considered elite. It's all here. Let's check it out.
This country has never seen. You know, we talk about the forgotten men and women. They're the smartest people. They work the hardest. They pay taxes. They do all of the things, and yet they were the forgotten people. And believe me, our people are the smartest and the hardest working. Smarter than anybody and the hardest working.
White people.
You know, a little thing I was talking about today. You ever notice they always call the other side, and they do this on purpose, the elite. The elite. Why are they elite? I have a much better apartment than they do. I'm smarter than they are. I'm richer than they are. I became president and they didn't. And I'm representing the greatest, smartest, most loyal, best people on earth. The deplorables. Remember that? The deplorables.
Oh, God, those are some of the worst people in the history of humanity, all assembled there, a bunch of mouth-breathing troglodytes with their pathetic, grotesque king.
He is just a right-wing radio host just riffing.
And that's it.
I was talking earlier in the day, you know, these guys, they don't even have good apartments.
They have good apartments. They got nothing. But that's it. That is the fusion of, like, the hucksterism... Obviously, all the subtextual racial stuff about who pays taxes, who works, all of that. That's all of the, that's actually him doing a dog whistle, which is interesting. And then the hyper personalization, because I like when you realize, like, first it's like the elites, and then like Hillary, who I beat. Why don't we print out the map to show everybody? It really, it's just like, it's just collective psychosis. Now, speaking of an actual elite, Michael Bloomberg. Michael Bloomberg, who presided over the mass, I mean, Rudy Giuliani, racist crypto fascist, wanted to turn New York City into a corporate playground. And you could actually see some of the sort of nationalization of some of the things that Jeff Sessions. So there's, again, obviously structural problems, profound racial class divisions and realities within policing. Of course, goes back to the roots, the, you know, history, very foundations of what created police departments to begin with. And the policies go much deeper. But the specific unshackling and the specific basically cultural encouragement from the top to be abusive, to terrorize people, to be bigots, is the line from Giuliani to Trump is clear. And then Bloomberg came in, and Bloomberg was the sort of technocratic managerial face of let's make New York a totally priced out, inequality riven playground for the global plutocracy and global oligarchy. And, you know, Mike Bloomberg is obviously a caricature of a type of politics and stance that has no buy-in in the vast majority of the country, but is always going to be radically overrepresented in elite circles because of money. And because of a certain type of cognitive capture for, you know, essentially just discredited neoliberal third way nonsense. So that's Michael Bloomberg. He is trash. His politics are terrible. And let's not go to the dum-dum end. On the other hand, he's committing to putting this figure that I had heard, and we'll see what the figure actually is. I had heard $80 million was when it was first announced yesterday to helping the Democrats win back the House. And he is going to support in gubernatorial races candidates from both parties, including John Kasich. Of course. And this is Bloomberg. I just want to – well, and I'll critique the reason. I mean, look. I'll just briefly quote from his piece in Bloomberg. Change ahead. I've never much liked political parties. I've always believed that we should put our country before party. Too many politicians practice the reverse with terrible consequences for the American people. You mean like giving you tax cuts and deregulating Wall Street? If you mean that, I agree. But oh, I don't believe in partisanship. I very much believe in the importance of politics and elections. That's how we can make change and progress in a democracy. Over the years, I have supported candidates in both parties who are willing to break with partisanship and special interests and seek common ground around solutions to make America better. I focus my philanthropy partially around bipartisan gun safety, environmental and immigration reform measures, and my political giving has focused around these priorities as well. He then, and I'll actually just one more graph, because this actually really captures the myopia of even that stance. In this last election, I spent $10 million to help Republican Pat Toomey get reelected in Pennsylvania. I disagree with him on many issues, but after the Newtown, Connecticut shooting, he broke with the NRA and co-wrote a bipartisan bill to close the background check loophole. So Pat Toomey, who is one of the most extreme far-right members in one of the most extreme far-right parties in the history of the planet, who is virulently against any, who is a active harmer of the environment, not in any way willing to work on any serious immigration mechanisms, even the types of pro-business ones that Bloomberg would support, basically co-signed an incredibly tepid piece of gun legislation that didn't even get passed, and that was enough for $10 million from Michael Bloomberg. This really shows you the technocratic, non-strategic thinking at work. This is a problem for after the election. So if Democrats win the House, and one of the reasons that it's so hard to turn the Democratic Party to the left is actually because, and Bhaskar Sankara and I talked about this on TMBS, is because there's so many – there isn't one centralized point of power in the Democratic Party. It's many different sort of fiefdoms. There's different committees. There's different state powers. Then there's also fundraising networks and then the political leadership in and outside of Washington. And there's been a lot of progress made in terms of shifting the party to the left. And you even see it, obviously, with people like Kamala Harris for Medicare for All and even Chuck Schumer, for God's sake, talking about moving in the right direction on legalizing marijuana. But after the election, the Democrats, if we get the results we need to have, and make no mistake, we absolutely need Democrats to take back the House and hopefully the Senate. But a Democratic House is the absolute bare minimum for any kind of democracy salvaging right now. And that's just reality. Again, we don't have time for this sort of silly posturing, as garbage as Democrats can and often are. The problem is after, when Michael Bloomberg wants his chips cashed in on another round of failed, discredited, oligarch-friendly centrism. But right now, this is a good thing. And we should be happy, even as someone who is going to have to fight Mike Bloomberg, the politics he represents, and the candidates he supports on a whole slew of the most important issues we face. The mechanics of that artillery being put in right now is undoubtedly a good thing for the specific concrete task that needs to be achieved in the moment. And I just wanted to do that segment just to demonstrate again that we can walk and chew gum at the same time. Is Bloomberg a political opponent? Obviously. Is his influence on the Democratic Party going to be negative and corrosive? Without a doubt. Is the fact that he's dumping a massive amount of money into something that is absolutely essential for preserving an even fighting chance of first some maintenance of democracy and norms? Yes. And then, of course, in 2020, actually reversing it and doing something real? No doubt. And also look out, because this, to me, indicates I'm sure he's thinking about running for president, and he might do the primary route. So we're definitely going to have to battle him. But this also should not be used as a dumb talking point to not support the essential task of Democratic control of the House right now, which is just anybody that would tell you that that isn't essential in 2018 should not be a verified political commentator. And that's how we should handle and approach those types of tensions.
And this is what happens when you have a popular front. Is
exactly.
It's going to be a subsidy to some lamer parts of the side.
Precisely. And the way we get to build to defeating that side is by holding back the rush now. I mean, just the lack of strategy that people had, that somehow if you open the floodgates to clown fascism, that would sort of have some type of boomerang effect to complete across-the-board victory.
If we let the fascists have enough power, we'll have a socialist revolution.
Yeah. I mean, it's never been true historically. So even Batista, for God's sakes, Batista was loosening up. That's one of the reasons that Castro didn't stay in jail. Okay, we're going to take a brief break, and we will be right back with Ed Caesar of The New Yorker. We're talking about this really, really fascinating story of the Gupta family, Bell Pottinger, this British PR firm, and there's a lot of implications out of it for really the sort of global spin business. We'll be right back. Now, who's hot, who not? Tell me who rock, who sell out in the stores? You tell me who flop, who cop the blue drop, who jewels got box, who mostly Gucci down to the blue drop. The same old pimp, Mace, you know ain't nothing changed but my limp. Can't stop till I see my name on the blimp. Guarantee me and sell for the love of luck. You don't believe in Harlem World? Double up. We don't play around, it's a bet, lay it down. Didn't know me 91, bet they know me now. I'm the young Harlem with the Goldie sound. Can't no pin beat. Hold me down, cooler, school me to the game. Now I know my duty. Stay humble, stay low, blow like Hootie. True pimp, spin no dough on the booty. Blue yell, there go Mace, there go your cutie. Call all the shots, rip all the spots, rock all the rocks, cop all the drops. I know you're thinking now when all the ball stops.
Ever home, gotta call me on the yacht. 10 years from now, we'll still be on top. Yo, I thought I told you that we won't stop. Now what you gonna do when it's cool that I got money much longer than yours and a team much stronger than yours? Violate me, this will be your day. We don't play, mess around, be DOA. Be on your way, cause it ain't enough time here. Ain't enough lime here for you to shine here. Deal with many women, but treat down fair. And I'm bigger than the city lights down in Times Square. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
No info for the DEA. Federal agents mad cause I'm flagrant. Tap myself and the phone in the basement. My team supreme, stay clean. Triple beam, lyrical dream. I be that. Catch a seat at all events bent. Send holsters, girls on shoulders.
Welcome back to the Majority Report. I'm Michael Brooks. Joining us now is Ed Caesar. He's a contributing writer at The New Yorker. Ed, thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you have a new piece in the June 25th, 2018 issue. It's a fascinating piece. It has a lot of elements that interest me. South Africa, PR, spin. It's called The Reputation Laundering Firm That Ruined Its Own Reputation. A PR company that worked with dictators and oligarchs deliberately inflamed racial tensions in South Africa and destroyed itself in the process. I guess before we get to South Africa, can you take us to the beginning? What was this firm? Who were they? Where did they come from, Bell Pottinger? What was the history, both of the firm itself, but also the kind of broader climate it came out of in the, you know, London public relations and spin business?
Sure. So Bell Pottinger had been around for a while, a couple of decades at least, and like a number of PR firms, they did a mixture of work. So they did really vanilla, uninteresting stuff for like grocery chains and, you know, handbag brands. But they also had a division that was called geopolitical that did work in overseas territories, quite often for quite controversial figures. And that could include, in Bell Pottinger's case, working for the government of Sri Lanka, after the Civil War, or working for, an oligarch that needed their help, or working in the case that I cover in the magazine, for a rich family in South Africa that wanted to change the conversation nationwide in South Africa. So the general environment in London is that London is the place where if you have a lot of money or a lot of power, it is a place where you can come and have your reputation managed or laundered in the more pejorative term by very effective PR men. Publicists, for some reason, this industry is a particularly lively one in London. And it's partly because London's emergence as a financial center in the last couple of decades has been wild. I think it really is the place where a lot of the world's financial activity takes place. And as it sits where it does, you know, close to Europe, not too far from New York, you know, sort of midway between America and the Far East, it's become this kind of nodal point in international, transnational wealth. And the PR industry has grown up in that environment. And there are a lot of firms who do similar types of work to Bell Pottinger. Bell Pottinger was different because its leader for a long time, Tim Bell, or Lord Bell as he was known, was so unrepentant about doing work for controversial figures. He loved the attention. And that's what gave it its reputation.
And so, yeah, so that across the board, these firms take on accounts of, in varying degrees, but taking on an account of an oligarch or a repressive regime or even an exploitive Western corporation, that is far from unusual. But the sort of appetite at which Tim Bell took on some of these causes and sort of enjoyed the controversy of those accounts was distinct. And also the other one you mentioned, which I think I just want to note for everybody, was also, I believe, in 2011, taking on the Bahraini royal family, literally in the midst of a very brutal crackdown that happened in the context of the political wave in the Middle East of 2011. Also the other thing to note is that certainly Bell personally and the firm in general is pretty Tory or Conservative Party aligned, and that makes some of the themes that they distorted and exploited in South Africa very ironic, because they essentially generated it was a right-wing firm that generated the right's dishonest representation of what a left-wing campaign would be on behalf of South African oligarchs. So that being said, who are the Gupta family? What was their connection with former President Jacob Zuma? And then how did they get in touch with Bell Pottinger?
Okay, well, I think that South Africa is still working out exactly what the Gupta's relationship with former President Jacob Zuma was. But in Precy, the Guptas were this family that had come from India and had been extremely successful in business. They had computer businesses and they had mining interests. They had newspapers. They'd developed this conglomerate of businesses. And they had become very close with Zuma in a way that struck many people as inappropriate, and then continued to strike people as corrupt. And the thing that they are accused of doing is of effectively running a shadow government in South Africa, whereby they were so entwined with the Zuma administration that the Gupta brothers had the power to offer ministerial posts in the South African government. There was one South African politician who claimed to have been offered a bribe of $44 million to take a certain ministerial post to further various interests of the Gupta brothers. And a term was coined for this behavior, which was called state capture. It was thought that the Guptas had captured the South African state. So Bell Pottinger came out to South Africa in the midst of some of these accusations being aired, and knowing, or they should have known, exactly who the Guptas were when they met them. And if they didn't know who they were, they had no excuse for not knowing who they were fairly soon after they first met them, because they were always in the news and it was a huge story in South Africa. And Bell Pottinger was one of at least two London firms that bid for work with them, and was paid, they won the account and they were paid a substantial retainer, $130,000 a month to do PR work. And some of that was just bog standard reputation management. And you can debate the rights or wrongs of that kind of work for controversial figures. I know plenty of people could defend it. But another part of the work was to advance this campaign that the Guptas wanted to promote, which was economic emancipation, they called it, which was essentially saying people of color in South Africa have been left out of the, you know, the fruits of economic growth for too long. In other words, that after apartheid had ended, people of color were essentially no better off than they had been under apartheid. And they wanted a campaign to highlight this. And it was a profoundly cynical suggestion, because what they wanted to do as, you know, non-white businessmen was to kind of cast themselves as outsiders in this, you know, this new environment. And they also wanted to cast their opponents as upholding this system that favored whites over non-white South Africans. And Bell Pottinger did that work. There is no doubt that there is a legitimate campaign or conversation to be had around economic inclusion in South Africa. The facts speak for themselves. It is a profoundly unequal country. But the cynicism with which this campaign was deployed and the people on whose behalf this campaign was employed and the tactics that were involved in the deployment of the campaign were all pretty odious. And eventually, Bell Pottinger's tactics were exposed and they were pilloried.
I actually do want to get to unpacking the distinctions there, and the dynamics, because I, you know, certainly this show, obviously, and I have a very, very left perspective, which is fascinating, because I could also see a certain weaponization of a very distorted identity politics as well. But before we get there, I mean, just be a little bit more even specific when you talk about what they were doing. They came up with specific phrases that members of Zuma's cabinet started using. They used also some of the same tactics that people are very interested in now with regards to Cambridge Analytica. Get a little bit more into the specifics of the campaign.
Sure. So, I mean, some of the ugliest stuff that they did was very low tech. I mean, it was published on Twitter and on blogs and so on, but it was essentially political cartoons that were, for instance, you know, a political cartoon that was commissioned by Bell Pottinger, not under their name, under this entity called Vertec, which was doing a lot of their work, this Twitter feed and blog site. And the cartoon showed a table groaning with food at which various white business people were eating while poor non-white South Africans ate the crumbs from the table. It's like deeply racially inflammatory idea. And you're saying certain things about the people who are at the table, which, you know, may or may not be true. It struck many people that this campaign was totally poisoning what is a very fragile and delicate ecosystem in South Africa, in which these conversations need to be had, but in the right way. And it didn't seem helpful to anyone to have it in this way. You know, they were also providing talking points for politicians about economic emancipation.
White monopoly capital.
Right, that phrase came into into prominence. So Bell Pottinger would deny having come up with the term, and I think that they're right in that. I think they certainly helped to popularize that term, white monopoly capital. Both them and the Gupta's own media empire helped to popularize that term. And white monopoly capital is this idea that, you know, white owned businesses and prominent white business people had seized the powerful business interests of the country for their own ends and had shut non-white South Africans out of it.
What's interesting about it here is definitely, and this is where we'll kind of pivot to South Africa more specifically, and I'll lay my red cards on the table. But there's a couple of dynamics at work. So one is that, in my read of it, one is that the South African transition hinged on sort of, you know, there was kind of three dynamics at work. One was that you had obviously this incredible achievement and very genuine policy of the ANC, that the answer to apartheid and systemic oppression is full, broad, inclusive democracy. And that really was not, you know, that was not spin. That's a very genuine and serious part of the African National Congress tradition. Then there was the reality that under the transition, and a lot of people who have gone on to be critics of Zuma, but people on the left, like Ronnie Kasrils, who I've had the pleasure of interviewing several times, said, you know, look, in the mid-90s, the macroeconomic rule book of the global financial system meant that as soon as we achieve political liberation, we cannot follow through on the things that we did need to do, of course, in a nonviolent and strategic manner. But in fact, there does need to be land reform. There does need to be mass redistribution along, you know, not only racial, but certainly class lines. And of course, there's a massive overlap in South Africa. And then the other two things to kind of put on the table are that the ANC has sort of been boxed into a position where the social democratic, the labor reform, the tripartite communist sort of alliance has been marginalized in terms of delivering the types of real left economic, smart left economic policies that would help ensure not only justice, but also the rainbow democracy. And it's been a conflict between people like Thabo Mbeki and now Cyril Ramaphosa, who are, you know, very centrist and very business friendly overall. And then Azuma, who adopted and diagnosed these problems, but in the most cynical manner possible, to forward pure kleptocratic capitalism by all accounts, and state capture. And then the irony of Bell Pottinger as a London-based, you know, right-leaning firm devising this campaign. But does it sort of strike home, though, that it's the cynicism of it does also show that there's all of these structural problems on the table that nobody is addressing, and it will inevitably be subsumed by those types of cynical advances without a genuine, you know, social democratic strategy.
I saw a poll either today or yesterday saying that 67% of South Africans support land reform.
Right.
There is an appetite for this conversation.
Of course, yeah.
And what happened in this case was that Zuma was fantastically corrupt,
yep,
and inept in many ways, and his cronies, the Guptas, who were not interested in the greater good of South Africa, I don't believe. They were interested in profit. And, you know, this argument has been deployed on behalf of people who are unworthy of it, in
right,
a sense.
Right, yep.
And I think it matters who's making those arguments.
Yep.
I am not a political reporter, but I just, you know, to me, narrative is incredibly interesting, and you know, when certain narratives gain traction, why they're doing so. This phrase, white monopoly capital, was used by Zuma and the Guptas to smear people who were trying to do good and interesting things. You know, so they would say of a politician,
right,
who is considered an enemy of them, well, he's in the pocket of white monopoly capital.
Right. Right.
You know, which is it's a racial slur.
They weren't doing a diagnosis of, right, but of course somebody could come and say, obviously the next phase of South Africa's development means that, you know, the capital monopolies need to be broken up and there needs to be redistribution. And of course there is a racial component to that. Is totally different than the cynic, like you say, the cynical just sort of weaponizing and also using it to smear anybody who said anything about what they did. And that was that kind of ironic, you know, weaponization of distorted identity politics.
Yeah.
If you took us back to London for a second, you said we kind of glossed over the other part of this story is just this ridiculous drama and very, very entertaining drama of these kind of British, I guess, madmen, whatever we're going to call them. The firm gets into trouble through this account, and then it becomes basically this whole, you know, just boardroom warfare. What's happening back at Bell Pottinger?
So what happened was there was a long-running feud, well before this account ever came to the firm, between the two people at the top of Bell Pottinger, Tim Bell, Lord Bell of Belgravia, this famous and fantastically colorful figure in British public relations, and a much younger man who had a greater stake in the business called James Henderson. And Henderson wanted Bell out of the company because he thought he was a threat to the company, and they clashed just in simple personality terms from the moment they started working together. And Bell didn't want to go. And eventually Henderson won that mini battle in the summer of 2016, And according to the very, very many people who spoke to me for the piece and documents I've seen and a gathering of evidence, Bell made it his business to destroy what was left of Bell Possinger. And he used the details of this South African account, which he himself had helped to win and run, as the explosion that he needed to, you know, to put under the rest of the company that still bore his name. And in the final scene, or the penultimate scene of the story, he sits down with a former partner and very explicitly says, "I am taking my revenge." You know, it's one of the most unusual, dramatic.
It's not particularly subtle.
Stories. It's not particularly subtle, but it's incredibly chilling.
Right.
I mean, that level of hatred. So that's the other part of this story. And to, you know, what's interesting for me, as somebody who writes long, you know, I write these long pieces for the New Yorker, and it's so interesting to see when these feuds start to impact beyond the walls of a company. You know, this feud between these two rich white businessmen, you know, had an effect on an entire nation, you know, 10,000 miles away, and it's kind of unforgivable, really, that this spilled over in that way.
And what? And now there's another firm that's sort of arisen out of this as well.
Right.
Where, I mean, there's that, and then there's also that some of this potentially spilled over into Cambridge Analytica. Could you touch on those two things as well?
Sure. Yeah. So there was the area of Bell Possinger that did a lot of this geopolitical work was called Bell Possinger Geopolitical, and a former partner there for very many years was someone called Mark Turnbull, who was in fact one of the people who was caught on camera recently bragging about Cambridge Analytica's work on foreign elections. And, you know, he had worked in Iraq and South Africa for Bell Possinger before he went to Cambridge Analytica. And it's just interesting. It is noteworthy to see how the tactics kind of continued from one place to another. And then the other part of the story is that a group, you know, Tim Bell's faction from Bell Possinger, when they were kicked out, went and started their own organization called Sans Frontières, which is, if you think deeply about it, it's a kind of an outrageous name for
outrageous for a Africa-focused kind of London-based PR firm. Yes.
Well, they may not call themselves Africa-focused,
but they have a lot of Africa, you know, clients.
They're definitely international. Yeah. International for sure.
They.
So. I mean, it was the previous name for Bell Possinger Geopolitical, and they would argue that, you know, they've got every right to use the phrase, but I know that Médecins Sans Frontières were not particularly happy about happy about them having the name back.
Well, they have every right, and we have every right to be a bit disgusted if we choose to be. Is there a broader? I mean, I guess, you know, it's sort of like these examples. You can always find the most flashy example, and certainly someone like Tim Bell makes, you know, I mean, it's part of what makes your story, I mean, is so well written and engrossing and fascinating. And there was a lot of, you know, the firm was censured by, you know, a sort of PR group association and so on. But yeah. I mean, how much do they really, I mean, they might stand out. There's some funny lines from other PR firms about, oh, well, that's a Bell Pottinger client. But more broadly, and particularly in the UK, I mean, Tony Blair even was doing essentially some,
right,
you know, comm services for Kazakhstan. How much of this is just, and in Washington, there's more strictures on lobbying, but certainly people foreign lobby for almost any government on the planet. I was short of North Korea, that might actually change in the next couple of years if things go.
It might change.
Yeah.
I'm sure some people are thinking up their bids.
Yeah, I have no doubt. So what's the big, is there a bigger picture here in terms of what governs this industry and how we think about it?
Well, I think nothing governs it.
Right.
But you know, as long as there are people with money and power, they're going to want their reputations to be as good as they can possibly be.
Right.
Yeah, you know, and that's why it's going to be a perennially interesting story to me, that people can come to see a nice man who went to a good school in London, and they go into a very respectable-looking office, and they tell, well, we can make certain things go away for you, we can make certain issues move down the agenda, we can possibly get you a couple of pieces in the, you know, in the newspapers here and there. You know, we can guide you to a softer, nicer place than the one you're in now. That's not going to change. There's no way you could regulate it, I don't think. It will just shift shape. Mm. And you know, there was a moment in which, when I was reporting this story, when someone, one of my sources, sent me this quotation from C.S. Lewis. And I sort of puzzled over it for a while. And it's a quotation about evil. And he said, I live in the managerial age in a world of admin. And the greatest evil is not now done in those sordid dens of crimes that Dickens loved to paint. It goes on to say, is conceived and ordered in clean, carpeted, warmed and well-lighted offices by quiet men with white collars and cut fingernails and smooth-shaven cheeks who do not need to raise their voices. And I thought a lot about that,
right.
Which is it's a really, really good idea that there is something profoundly evil about some of the things that I uncovered in this piece. You know, there is a moment at which Bell Pottinger are advising the Bahraini Economic Development Board, but they do some extra work for the Bahraini government, and the Arab Spring happens.
Yep.
Bell Pottinger are asked to prepare a list of the most influential Bahraini dissidents for their client, which they do.
Yep.
And, you know, Bahrain was torturing and killing dissidents at that time. And it's hard to get rid of the feeling that this might be the most profoundly evil thing you could ever imagine a PR doing, is essentially like pointing the finger at people you need to target.
Yep.
I just don't see how it stops. And I'm not here to tell anyone how to make it stop. I just, you know, my job is to shine a light in the dark places.
And you did it incredibly well. I really recommend, obviously we have a link to the piece on the homepage, and everybody should read
Thank
the piece.
You.
Oh, it's really my pleasure. Thank you for doing this. The reputation laundering firm that ruined its own reputation, by Ed Caesar. It's in the, I believe, the current issue of the New Yorker, the June 25th issue of the New Yorker.
That's it.
Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Okay, folks, we are going to go to the fun half. And you know, your calls, your IMs, all that good stuff. Become a member of the Majority Report today, majority.fm/become a member. Find all the different ways you can support the show at justcoffee.coop and so on. Yes, Brendan?
How about that C.S. Lewis quote, folks?
That was amazing. Ooh. I actually want to find that. Really, that's perfect. Matt, tell us about, if you're done hacking, tell us about Literary Hangover.
Literary Hangover, we've done Rip Van Winkle this weekend. You can check that out on iTunes, all the places you listen to podcasts, and also patreon.com/literaryhangover if you want to support it.
And Rip Van Winkle did not like his wife.
No, he basically didn't like his wife, so he went, he just wandered around just hanging out with anybody besides his wife.
Yep.
He got lost in the woods with some sort of spirits, which were possibly the ghosts of Henry Hudson's crew, got drunk and bowled with them and fell asleep, and then woke up and made sure his wife was gone before announcing himself to his daughter.
It's like, all right, that's commitment.
That's a true American story.
True American story. Of course, check out The Antifada, patreon.com/TheAntifada for Jamie's podcast. On the Michael Brooks Show this past week, Bhaskar Sunkara and I talked about American socialist tradition, strategies for the Democratic Party and the left, some really interesting, distinct electoral ideas there. Willie Q, rapper. This Sunday, a bit of a different illicit history primer. Stephen Robbins and I, Ronald Reagan and I, are actually, we did a deep dive on immigration policy and what the policy should be, what the response can be now, and the kind of broader framework of ironing out the policy. There's a Discord community. There's a ton going on there. Check it out on iTunes or YouTube.
And while we're plugging podcasts, Stephen Robbins, Reagan, podcast Redirect is also a very timely view on what's going on with immigration.
Redirect, Immigration Law and Perspectives. That's indispensable. I listen to that every week. Get the whole thing from me at patreon.com/TMBS, patreon.com/TMBS. We are now well past, that 2,000 patrons is in the horizon. That's very exciting for us and also very terrifying for our stomachs. 646-257-3920, 646-257-3920. We will see you in the fun half.
You are in for it.
All right, folks, 646-257-3920. See you in the fun half.
Are you ready?
Who sent us this?
Anarchy. Alpha males are back. And the alpha males are back.
Just as delicious as you can imagine.
The alpha males are back.